So this terminology of the blue economy has troubled me. Many are uncomfortable with the term blue economy because they see it as a focus of oceans supporting large enterprises such as oil, minerals, gas, wind, transportation, tourism, salmon farming, and very little on aquatic foods.
Humans have fished for millennia, 40,000 years, according to some scientists. Today, fish provide protein and jobs to billions of people. But as with meat in general, the ethics of eating seafood has come under scrutiny, both because we've until recently had a very bad track record with overexploiting fisheries, as well as new revelations about the illicit and illegal practices, such as slavery, that infect a wide range of industrial fisheries. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Today, I'm speaking with Shakuntala Thilstead, 2021's World Food Prize winner and global lead for nutrition and public health at the international nonprofit WorldFish. Fisheries no doubt face many challenges, but countless coastal communities and cultures have built and maintained strong, mutually supportive relationships with fisheries. Dr. Thilstead and I talk about nutrition, power, and the potential to build healthy and sovereign communities with fisheries around the world. Let's dig in. Dr. Shakuntala Thilstead is Global Lead for Nutrition and Public Health at WorldFish, a nonprofit research and innovation institution that is part of One CGIAR, and which seeks to create, advance, and translate scientific research on aquatic food systems. Dr. Thilstead was awarded the 2021 World Food Prize and the Arrow Global Food Innovation Award. She is a specialist in nutrition-sensitive approaches to aquatic food systems and a tireless proponent of supporting nutrition and health and food sovereignty for poor and vulnerable populations, including small-scale fishing communities around the world. Shakuntala, congratulations on the awards, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Phil, and thank you for having me.
I'd like to start, if it's okay with you, by talking about the importance of fisheries worldwide and small-scale capture fisheries in particular, because people in North America don't know a lot generally about small-scale fisheries. You know, our aquatic foods don't factor hugely into North American food systems. So I find when I talk with people who aren't actively working in fisheries that they don't grasp the scale or the importance of small-scale fisheries around the world. Can you tell us a bit about why fisheries, in your mind, are so important and why they can be so important looking forward to a more food secure future?
They are important for multiple reasons. I work a lot with foods and nutritious foods. Fisheries, and especially small-scale fisheries, are an important source of diverse, nutritious, aquatic foods for many. But we know also that the entire sector is important for income and livelihoods. If I can give some statistics, it is estimated that 120 million people depend on fisheries for livelihood. And of these, 93% are small-scale fisheries. And 97% of these are from low and middle-income countries. And women who haven't been considered in the past, it's now known that they make up about half of the workforce, especially in the supply chains and the markets of the products from small-scale fisheries. And importantly, also, the data show us that 2/3 of global catches come from small-scale fisheries. So all in all, small-scale fisheries are important for nutrition, for livelihoods, for income, for culture. And it should not be overlooked when we talk about food systems, when we talk about foods, and when we consider foods from both land and water systems.
And I've heard you also link small-scale fisheries to the right to food. Can you tell me about this?
Well, if we consider a food secure future, the global narrative has changed from the days of when the Green Revolution started in the 60s. And at that time, we were all concerned about stark starvation and deaths, with securing people sufficient staple foods, for example, rice in Asia, maize in Africa. Now, today, we have a more holistic understanding of foods and diets and production systems. And we know that we must not only take into consideration quantity, but also the quality of foods. Sufficient, diverse, nutritious, and safe foods. And this principle builds also on the principle of the right to food, that we must have sufficient, nutritious, and culturally acceptable foods for all, and the concept of leaving no one behind.
I've long felt in my work that there's just this enormous blind spot about fisheries when talking about food systems. And within that blind spot, a second blind spot, that when people think fish, they think of the large scale, but misunderstand that small scale fisheries are at the center, at the core of it all. And so I wonder if we can do something about that and change the narrative. You know, a focus of this podcast is about changing narratives. And one of the really, I think, critical aspects of your work is about changing the narrative, or at least recognizing the difference between feeding and nourishing. Could you talk a little bit about this and how you came to this difference?
Well, I work a lot with groups and others who work in the realm of production systems. However, I start with consumption and consumption patterns. And when you do so, you get a very different perspective of food and nutrition. So beginning with diets, it's important to consider first different population groups, different geographies, different culture, seasonality and diversity, and not just consider few staple foods, so as I mentioned before. When you hear the term feeding, that relates very much to making sure that the growing global population has the quantity of stable foods to supply energy. We must consider also micronutrients. We must consider essential fatty acids. We must consider other components of foods. We must also consider the quality in terms of food safety. So when we do all of this, we change the narrative from feeding to nourishing. So foremost is a focus on people and different groups of people, and a focus on diversity of systems, not just production systems, and not just the quantity of a few staple foods.
That's a really great and rich answer. Thank you for that. In it, and in your last couple of answers, I've heard you talk about a couple of, let's say, narratives, Green Revolution, sort of a productionist narrative about what food systems do. They produce calories or energy. And another one that's emerging too, and I think it's related, is the blue economy. For the listeners who may not have heard this, it's this notion that the ocean is the next frontier for economic growth and development. But in times also seems to get packaged as maybe a way to support or enhance or empower local small-scale fishing communities too, right? And so do you have thoughts on this emergence of talk around this so-called blue economy and where it's going?
Well, I've thought a lot about that, Phil. And so this terminology of the blue economy has troubled me. If you will look up the definitions of blue economy, it's written that it was conceived at the Rio+20 United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development in 2012. and that the World Bank defines the blue economy as sustainable use of ocean resources for economic growth, improved livelihood, and jobs, while preserving the health of ocean ecosystem. And already there, I have an issue, because if we would talk about food systems and we would talk about food, land, and water systems, then it's all water systems. It's just not the oceans or coasts. It's also inland fisheries, and which is so very important for inland communities. Also, many are uncomfortable with the term blue economy because they see it as a focus of oceans supporting large enterprises such as oil, minerals, gas, wind, transportation, tourism, salmon farming, and very little on aquatic foods. I would like to see terminologies that take much more focus on justice, equity, rights, and that we consider both marine and inland waters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really appreciate that you drew our attention there to the justice components and to try to shed this notion that any growth is good growth, any development is good development, but instead ask the question, for whom and by whom is that development happening? And to maybe get specific, you know, we've talked about this, I think, in the past, that a number of people don't realize how much that is common in the industrial fisheries industry to turn fish and fish byproducts into animal feed for aquaculture. And earlier you mentioned salmon farming, but also for land-based livestock production. And that's very different than what you're describing about aquatic foods. Are there alternatives emerging? I mean, how do we escape this trap, I guess, is the real question.
Well, again, with the narrative we have of growing global population and therefore a focus on quantity of more food, it's a very narrow focus. And if I would jump to another area, I mean, if we look at loss and waste of foods, and especially perishable foods as aquatic foods are, then the data shows us that about one third of the food that's produced is lost and wasted. So should we be putting so much focus on producing more? Or should we be using some of that investment in production systems to reduce loss and waste? And considering what you said, what you asked me about foods being used for making animal feeds, what we haven't done is look at these pelagic small fish species, which are used for making fish meal and fish oil, such as the anchovies from Peru or the sardines in West Africa, sardines from India, which is used in the growing shrimp industry. We know that these pelagic small fish, we know about their nutrient composition, we know about their values, for example, for cognition, for growth, for pregnancy, for lactation, and therefore how important these small pelagic fish are for meeting the needs of people and for national development and intergenerational benefits.
I think it's important to clarify here that a large proportion of small-scale fisheries are part of what's called the informal economy. This means that they are not well protected, regulated, or even recognized or valued within institutions, organizations, and governments. This kind of informal work actually comprises about two-fifths of the global economy, and most people alive contribute to informal economies in some way. To share a sense of the challenges this creates for small-scale fisheries, I'm revisiting a clip of an interview I did last year with Mara Hart from the organization Future of Fish. Here she is talking about the challenges that small-scale fishers faced when trying to cope with the disruptions of COVID-19.
Small-scale artisanal fisheries are some of the most vulnerable communities in the world. There's not normally a lot of resources or safety nets built in. Part of the problem is when you have small scale is there isn't a way to finance, there isn't a way to access loans and the normal type of, you know, formal financial structures that exist for other kinds of businesses don't for fishers. Why we focus so much on finance is that a lot of fishers are informal. They're not part of the formal economy. That means that they couldn't apply for the relief funds because they didn't have the paperwork to prove what their income was or that they were part of the workforce. They couldn't get unemployment. They couldn't get some of these benefits.
In this light, it makes sense that Dr. Filsted's answers focus so much on protecting communities that are vulnerable and marginalized and leaving no one behind. Back to the interview. Dr. Filsted, there's a lot of conflicting information out there, a lot of sobering information about the state of environmental issues around the world, including a lot of challenges in fisheries. I wonder if there's a bright spot that you see, something people are doing to reframe fisheries, to help fisheries that work for people emerge. What do you see in your work?
Well, if I would keep to the global perspective, I think the narrative has changed. If we look at the UN Food Systems Summit that took place last year, 2021, there was quite a lot of focus on nature-positive solutions and the importance of fisheries to food systems. Also this year at COP26, for the first time, I was told that this was the first time that there was this integration of climate change, climate solutions, and food systems solutions. And this year, as you know, is the International Year of Artisanal Fisheries and Aquaculture. And therefore, there is this recognition of small-scale fisheries, which I think will further bring fisheries within the mainstream of solutions for transforming food systems across the world. So yes, I'm quite positive about the changes. I didn't think that we would get here in my lifetime.
Well, is there, speaking of that, and if you had a crystal ball to look forward, what would you like to see change even more? If you could push that change even a little bit further, what would you like to see change?
Well, I would like to see the recognition of the rich diversity of fisheries. It's just not fish. Aquatic foods are animals, including fish, other animal source foods, but also plants and microorganisms. And we should consider this rich diversity and seasonality and the cultural aspects of aquatic foods, so that we take into consideration tradition, culture, religion, and people, just not the food. And I do think we are getting there again at the UN Food Systems Summit. There was a focus on traditional knowledge, indigenous knowledge, indigenous populations, women and youth. And I do think if we bring in these different communities, these different population groups, and get them mainstream into the work we do, and just not leave it to governments and policies or international donor organizations or the private sectors. Ensure that we bring in the views and values of communities and peoples, that we will get you know, we will be at a much better place than we are today with fisheries and in general with the food systems that can nourish our growing population, nourish people, and also take into consideration planetary boundaries.
That is a great and optimistic place to leave it. I really appreciate that answer, and I'm right there with you in hoping for that. I do wonder
we can work together on this. I mean, think if you can bring populations, if you can bring communities together, for example, communities around the Great Lakes of Africa together with community, with First Nation communities in Canada, or, you know, communities in Greenland or the Faroe Islands. I do think that having these communities work together will be very powerful to move the agenda forward.
I 100% agree, and I'm going to take you up on that. Thank you so much. This was just great.
And thank you so much, Phil, and I look forward to working with you, and I hope it changes, that we can travel and we can meet each other and we can work together and we can, you know, we can go out to the field and work with communities.
This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northern California. Today, we heard from Dr. Shakuntala Filsted of World Fish, part of One CGIAR. Funding for this podcast was from the Arrow Food Institute and the University of Guelph and Voice Ed Radio. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.